This meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:20 p.m. Tuesday, March 24, 2026 in Davis 106. Members present are Representatives Schwanke, Ruffridge, Mears, Gray, Fields, and myself, Representative Mina Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Staffing the committee today, we have Andrew Giannotti, our Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, Kyla Tupo, our LIO Moderator, and Katie Giorgio, my committee aide. If you need anything during the meeting, please don't hesitate to get her attention. First off, we have a presentation from the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness on how housing is healthcare. We've talked a little bit in this committee about social determinants of health and how there are different aspects in someone's lives that impact their healthcare outcomes. And so we really appreciate the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness to give a more in-depth presentation about this intersection. I would like to invite Owen Brooks, Director of Organizational Development at the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, to put himself on the record and begin your presentation.
Hello. Thank you, Chair. My name is Owen Brooks. I'm the Director of Organizational Development with the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, and I appreciate the time today to chat with you.
Thank you. Please proceed. And we have been joined by Representative Mike Prox at 3:21 p.m.
So today, I hope that we will cover common health-related needs for people experiencing homelessness, unhoused people's experiences with health care, and the public health connections to the homeless prevention and response system. I'll also dive in at the end to how we use data for system improvement, all through the lens of social determinants of health. Before I talk about housing specifically, I just want to say that we spend a lot of time talking about health systems, like how somebody receives medical care, what kind of setting they receive it in, and how public health meets the needs of the populations it serves, and of individual behaviors such as smoking, working out, drinking, and how those impact health outcomes. But two less talked about issues are social and economic factors and the physical and social environment, all being affected by public policies and spendings. While they're all interrelated to a significant degree, any change to health systems or individual behaviors will not transform health outcomes without concurrent changes in the other areas. This is true on both an individual and population health level health outcomes. So you've already talked about social determinants of health, and for that reason, I won't spend much time on this slide, but I will go through all of the areas again, just to point out that housing is impacted by all of these areas. Starting at the top, we have healthcare access and quality, which includes health coverage. People experiencing homelessness and with unstable housing have higher uninsured rates than the general public, and that rate is different in different studies, but is usually about twice the rate of uninsured to the general public. It also includes access to primary care and treatment for chronic conditions. And for people with unstable housing, often the first place they go or a consistent place they access services is the emergency department, not the appropriate site of care. And transportation. It is very difficult to manage transportation in addition to unstable housing situations. Moving through clockwise, we have neighborhood and built environment, which includes factors like quality of housing, which I will discuss in the second half of the presentation extensively. Also, whether there's crime or violence in a neighborhood, whether there are stores that sell healthy foods, and access to information such as internet access or broadband. Continuing down, we have social and community context. This includes things like civic participation, whether or not an individual has experienced discrimination, whether they've been incarcerated, and social cohesion, so how well a person fits into the community where they live. Coming around to economic stability, this absolutely impacts housing. If you are not employed at a rate at which you can afford housing, you are cost burdened by your housing. And housing instability enormously affects healthcare access. If you are moving frequently or couch surfing, follow-up appointments can be difficult to make, as can just keeping a regular schedule. And education is uniquely impacts health outcomes. People with higher levels of education have better health outcomes, and people with negative health conditions have harder time attending school, harder time concentrating in school. And this education piece also affects income for individuals. So when we're talking about housing status and unhoused people's experiences with healthcare, there's three kind of significant things I will address today. The primary barriers, what are the negative health outcomes, and the strategies currently in place in Alaska to address those barriers and improve those health outcomes. These touch on all of the social determinants of health, and that is why I showed that slide. The lack of insurance and financial resources directly impacts a person's ability to receive services in the proper environment. Somebody who lacks transportation or is reliant upon public transportation may find it difficult to maintain appointments at a primary care site. And if they're closer to an emergency department, that might be a more logistically easy place for them to arrive. It also impacts the ability to access pharmacies and follow-up appointments. Again, unstable housing. When you are concerned about where you're sleeping that month, that week, that night, the last thing on your mind is following up with healthcare. Delayed healthcare results in negative health outcomes and higher costs. People need to be able to focus on their health and not worry about basic needs such as housing. There's also significant mistrust of the healthcare system. When clients go to receive services and are referred to as frequent flyers, or, oh, that person's just here for a sandwich or a blanket, there's a built-in power disparity where somebody is not receiving the services that they need in the way they need them, and it creates a dynamic in which they won't follow up with the care plan prescribed by their providers. There's also significant stigma and discrimination experienced by people who are homeless. And within providers, it's really needed to have education about what those barriers are and why the people show up in the conditions that they do. There's also a lack of coordination between providers, and not just amongst healthcare providers, but between housing providers and homeless service providers and other social services. When there is not a team working towards a common goal for an individual or family with their health, people often feel like they're telling the same story about their condition to multiple providers and not receiving any kind of follow-up regarding those stories. And when health worsens over time, people are less likely to engage in care plans. So what are the health outcomes that result from these barriers? Increased use of emergency services, high utilization, and high-cost interventions. According to the National Healthcare for the Homeless, people experiencing homelessness are 3 to 4 times more likely to die prematurely. The life expectancy of a person experiencing homelessness is 48 years. That is roughly 30 years less than the general population. They are 2 times more likely to have a heart attack or stroke, and 3 times more likely to die of heart disease between the ages of 25 and 44 years old. There's also increased risk of preventable disease, longer lengths of stay, and co-occurring disorders and treatment-resistant pathologies. According to the National Healthcare for the Homeless, at least 25% of people experiencing homelessness have a serious mental illness, and a majority of these individuals also experience substance use disorders. In a recent United States Interagency Committee on Homelessness Federal Strategic Plan, they did a health analysis of people experiencing homelessness compared to the general population. I'll point out just a few of these conditions here, but a person experiencing the red bar is people experiencing homelessness, the yellow bar is general population, and for dementia, it's roughly 3 times. For viral, chronic, or acute hepatitis, it's 6 times the rate. For chronic obstructive lung disease, it's more than double. These conditions are difficult to manage when housing is uncertain for an individual and create additional barriers to access and worsened health conditions. epilepsy is 3 times as high. Being an epileptic and not having stable housing is absolutely a major health barrier and issue.
And Mr. Brooks, I would like to pause right here just to see if the committee has any particular questions.
Sure.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Brooks, when you said that the life expectancy for a homeless person is 48, is that for the U.S.?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Please proceed.
Thank you. So we have some strategies that are nationally recognized, and the major one is receiving team-based care will improve outcomes. We have examples of it already in place in the state, and I'll talk about those a little bit later. But it's very vital to build trust and to center client decisions and for care to be continuous across providers. When somebody is receiving care in multiple federally or state-funded programs, we should know, and we should be working together to reduce the costs for each individual or household. And in Alaska, that looks like Housing First initiatives, which prioritize people into housing based on vulnerability, layered with supportive services so that they maintain that housing and can begin working on their health problems. Also, mobile health care services. We have some here in Juneau and some in Anchorage where a van or a bus will go to a shelter or go to encampments equipped with a small clinic setting where people can have individual appointments with providers and do things like STI screening, vaccinations, primary care, as well as physicals. It's also important to integrate social services into healthcare settings, having a case manager who understands the family dynamic and family needs and the health needs of all the individuals within that family and what benefits are available to that family. Again, addressing mistrust and stigma through education of providers and advocacy and policy change, which is what this body works towards. So what are the public health connections to the homeless prevention and response system? I'll briefly talk about what our organization does in Alaska. I'll touch on some of the programs that are operating here that are really innovative and doing nationally leading work. And then I'm going to dive deeply into the subpar rural housing conditions. So as a HUD continuum of care, we are mandated by federal statute to do 4 primary activities: policy and planning, data and evaluation, grants, and advocacy and education. We set all of the policies that guide all continuum of care funded programs for housing and homeless services for everywhere in Alaska outside of Anchorage. We also coordinate with housing providers to plan the homeless prevention and response system, which is the network of services and housing options to meet all subpopulation needs. We also operate something called coordinated entry, which prioritizes households for housing based on vulnerability, understanding that we have limited resources and high level of need. We also support best practices through technical assistance. So we work with housing providers and healthcare providers to understand what the national best practices are. In data and evaluation, we monitor data, and I will share some of that with you today. And we report that to the Department of Housing and Urban Development in the United States. I will say that we are the 3rd highest performing rural COC in America. And that is our annual bonus awards reflect the high performance, not of us, but of our housing providers and the staff who run those housing programs. We're also a funder. We are the collaborative applicant for the annual notice of funding opportunity through the HUD. And it is one of the only sustainable sources of income for housing providers. We also leverage philanthropic and state resources, such as the Homeless Assistance Program administered by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, to ensure providers have the resources they need. And finally, we advocate to improve policy at the local, state, and federal levels and convene providers to determine what those advocacy goals are.
I have a question. So Alaska has 2 COCs. The other one is the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness.
Yes.
Can you talk about how you work with the other COC? I know that having 2 COCs is a lot different from a lot of other states where you have a lot more entities that are working together.
Thank you, Chair Mina. In America, there are 400 COCs. They are geographic designations. We have very close collaboration with the Anchorage Coalition because there is enormous crossover between clients across the two COCs. And we have several positions which are co-funded through the both COCs to create efficiencies between the two. Statewide, in a year, there are around 15,000 households that access homeless services in our state in a single year. And a lot of those move from rural, which we cover, to urban spaces. I'm showing you this very complicated, this is one of the reports we generate for HUD, and I really want you to focus on two things, the white box on the left and the green box on the right. The HUD Continuum of Care program does not fund emergency shelter. It only funds housing programs. Why that is because we see a better percentage of households exiting housing programs to permanent destinations, no longer needing services through federally funded programs, than the percentage of people who go into emergency shelter. If somebody can be moved directly into a housing program with supports, it is more likely they will no longer need support and exit. However, if they enter emergency shelter and aren't diverted into a housing program, the likelihood of them exiting to a permanent destination is significantly less than every other funded intervention. So what's happening really well in Alaska? There's programs primarily in Juneau and Anchorage, but also in the Mat-Su that are doing amazing things, and actually some in Fairbanks as well. The Juneau Bartlett Hospital has a multi-visit patient program, and the Mat-Su Regional Medical Center has a high-utilizer Mat-Su or HUMS program. This means there's case management embedded in emergency departments that coordinate with housing providers and homeless service providers. So when there's a referral to a housing placement for an individual, that person can be made aware of it no matter where they are. Or if there's a medical need for somebody staying in shelter or in a federally funded housing program, that coordination can happen cross-directionally. Additionally, there's two federally qualified health centers who have a primary focus on people experiencing homelessness and have that team-based care model really excellently implemented. That's Front Street Clinic, operated by Search, and the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Clinic in your district. And this is a place where people can go to a primary care visit and then get connected to a case manager and then be referred to a vision appointment or a dental appointment or a psychiatry appointment, and all under one roof, an individual's healthcare needs can be met. They can receive medically assisted treatment for substance use disorders or counseling for mental health issues. We also have coordinated street outreach in places, mobile crisis teams, and mobile integrated health, where diversion from emergency services can take place and that trust can be built. In Anchorage, we have complex care that helps people who are medically fragile and should be in assisted living situations live in a non-congregate setting while verification of disability is received. We have a brilliant health clinic in the Brother Francis Shelter. If you haven't been there, visit those providers. They know what they're talking about, and they know who they serve, and they do it really thoughtfully. As well as at Brother Francis Shelter, we have medical respite beds, so people are not discharged from hospital stays and end up in a congregate shelter where conditions can worsen.
Could you talk a little bit more about street outreach, which organizations are doing it, and where in the state?
In Fairbanks, there's an amazing organization that does it. I'm blanking on their name right now, but I will follow up with you after the committee to give you that information. They are funded municipally. We also have coordinated street outreach, or did in Anchorage, with medical providers and other service providers. And then there's mobile crisis teams. And the mobile integrated health, I don't know all the communities that have it. I do know Ketchikan does because I chatted with them for a long time. It is a national model. It is embedded in fire departments often. And these are people with a kind of mobile clinic that can go around directly to folks sleeping in doorways or encampments or places where there's five families in a kind of dilapidated structure and meet with them and chat with them versus getting calls to the police or to the fire department regarding these individuals.
Representative Prax.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, do you have any, well, if you were a politician, you'd call it a door hanger or a rat card or something that could be given out to people to give, you meet somebody on the street, you want to help them out, don't know how, to give them some direction of where to go, some ideas.
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, there is something called, I forget, it's 9/11 resources, I think. 988 resources. Thank you. Which is a resource map for the whole state. It's available on the DOH website. It's not a business card, and it requires a computer to navigate. But currently, that's the most extensive mapping of resources we have in the state. We're working to build that out further, but it is a separate nonprofit that we do support.
Follow up? Yes, thank you. Would that be available via a cell phone?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's mobile app conducive through the chair.
Okay. Any other questions from committee? All right, please continue.
The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health developed a system to rate housing quality and then assess housing quality's impact on health conditions. It rates three factors: physical inadequacy, housing cost burden, and poor neighborhood health perception. This really covers structural deficiencies, including plumbing issues, mold exposure, the proportion of household income spent on housing, which limits financial flexibility, and indicators such as abandoned buildings, crime reports that influence residents' well-being. In Alaska, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation completed a 2018 housing study that looked at many of those factors in Alaskan housing. In this graph, I really want to point out the bar on the far right is the Bering Strait. It has the lowest percentage of homes with increased risk of indoor air quality issues, with roughly 30% of homes, one out of three in the Bering Straits region, having increased risk of indoor air quality issues. And on the left-hand side in the Siri region, more than 60% of homes, so more than half, have an increased risk of indoor air quality issues, and more than 25%, so 28%, with severe risk of indoor air quality issues.
Thank you. So Siri would be Anchorage. Why does Anchorage have, through the chair, why does Anchorage have such terrible indoor air quality issues? Why is Anchorage's worse than the rest of the state?
We would have to look at the breakdown by region. The Cold Weather Climate Center performed a lot of these home quality assessments for AHFC. This is the most recent data we have. There's no reason for us to believe this has improved drastically since 2018. I think the big issue across the whole state is the age of the housing infrastructure. The majority of homes built in Alaska are very old, and with older building quality requirements.
Follow up?
Could it be, through the chair, that Anchorage homes are more airtight because they're not as old or run down as the houses across the rest of Alaska?
It's absolutely about mechanical air ventilation. And also in Alaska, we have extreme temperatures. And so there's a desire for them to be airtight, but that also leads to stale air, mold, issues with overall quality of air in the home. And if operating a Toyo stove or a gas stove, the overall air quality in the home is also impacted.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. Again, this is divided by ANCSA region and is the same AHFC housing condition report. This shows homes with incomplete kitchens. The Chulista region has roughly one quarter of homes with incomplete kitchens. This means a home without a sink, stove, or refrigerator. This directly connects to a household's ability to provide nutritious food for all residents. The Johns Hopkins study found that poor housing conditions were significantly associated with negative self-reported health outcomes. Specifically, census tracts with poor housing quality scores had higher proportion of adults who were reporting fair or poor general health. And in addition, poor mental health outcomes were reported and in more prevalent in census tracts with worse housing conditions. These associations remained significant after adjusting for other factors, highlighting the independent impact of housing quality on population health. When you look at the Johns Hopkins report, the graph shows the whole Western Alaska with very poor housing quality. And finally, we're going to look at overcrowding rates. Alaska has the highest rate of overcrowding in the United States in the Chulista region. You can look at the bottom note showing United States is between 0 and 5% overcrowded. And in the Chulista region, there are more homes that are severely overcrowded than are just overcrowded. Overcrowding means more than one person per room. That includes bathrooms, dining rooms, and kitchens. And severely overcrowded means more than 1.5 persons per room. When an individual in an overcrowded home has a substance use disorder or a serious mental illness, every other household member in that home is affected by that person's health condition. The Johns Hopkins report findings support the link between health and housing. Poor housing conditions expose residents to environmental risks, including mold, vermin, and inadequate heating, all of which are precursors for long-term conditions like asthma, cardiovascular disease, and respiratory disease. Financial burdens due to high housing costs also trigger pressure, food insecurity, and delays in seeking medical care. And then percent of homes with a one-star energy rating, the ANCSA region that receives the highest percentage of homes that are not properly insulated is Sealaska Southeast here. A one-star energy rated home will cost at least $2,000 a year just in heating fuel. These additional costs create a significant burden on households. They're the least efficient homes in Alaska, and they use up to four times more energy than a new home built to the current building energy efficiency standard. So what do we do when we look at the housing conditions and the data that we collect from the federally funded housing programs? Continuums of care are required to keep a data system to track client demographics and services accessed. The demographic data is self-reported, and the service data is entered by providers. HUD funding for the data system represents roughly one-tenth of the cost of operating the data system. So while they mandate we have a robust system, they don't fund it. And a COC is graded annually on its performance of those programs, meaning all projects that receive funding are monitored for where folks end up, what services they received, and who returns to homelessness or stays housed or exits the system. It also tracks things like household income, and we score highly when a household increases their income. And Alaska does this very well.
Oh, going back to the data slide, could you talk a bit more about how you collect and share data as the state COC in comparison to the Anchorage Coalition? And then additionally, what are the gaps in data that we have?
Thank you, Chair Mina. We have a slightly unusual implementation of the Homeless Management Information System. We share the system with Anchorage, so all of the data goes into one system. You can access it separately, and you can access it by program, and you can access it by community. So if you have questions about your community's homelessness data, I'm happy to run reports for you. Because it is so expensive, we thought together, why do we need two different data systems? Can we use one? I'm going to talk a little bit more about the costs and what we would like to do with the data system. We currently use a software that is aging out, that is no longer staffed by engineers who can change it. And we really want to track people who are receiving services from multiple federally funded and state funded programs. And the current software doesn't allow for that. But Anchorage and the Alaska Coalition work together on setting the policies. We have to both agree to the policies that then are implemented for every program to follow regarding data collection. The data collection is done by housing providers, and then we analyze and report to the federal government.
Could you also talk about the role of the Department of Health's Office on Homelessness Health Intervention and Prevention and how they work with you all on the HMIS and other issues?
Chair, respectfully, I have a whole slide about it.
Oh, wow. Never mind.
At the end.
Spoilers.
But you are thinking the same direction we are, which is that a newly created division within the Department of Health really to focus on health outcomes and preventative health interventions for people experiencing homelessness or with unstable housing are working on a data sharing pilot to determine who is receiving housing services, who is not enrolled in Medicaid, and then to get them enrolled in Medicaid so that they can receive services.
We'll get there.
So HUD has five main priorities for data sharing, specifically with medical providers. We have a more expansive view. We would like to share data with Department of Corrections and potentially with the Office of Family Services. But the medical data sharing really hits on five points. State-funded housing and healthcare programs have very different processes and regulations for both the funding and the evaluation, and there is currently no coordination between the systems outside of the pilot project we're doing currently. While HUD prioritizes healthcare integration, they don't give any funding for healthcare integration, so they will score us higher if we do it, but they won't fund us to do it. We really want to provide housing quickly to people experiencing homelessness who are highly vulnerable. A person in a wheelchair, a person who's an amputee, a person with major medical issues or disabilities, the proper place is not on the street or in a congregate shelter. Within a data sharing agreement, you can instantly access documents such as verification of disability that could qualify an individual for a housing program. We also want to coordinate between the healthcare and homeless services and housing providers to improve health outcomes and better referrals for housing using real-time data. It will lead to an ease in locating individuals who are engaged in a variety of services and allow hospitals to identify patients who have an open, coordinated entry assessment, which assesses their vulnerability. We want to understand the complexities of medical and social needs of individuals and families. We want to improve the health outcomes, but also allow for analysis by subpopulation and address policy concerns related to healthcare costs and disparate outcomes by race. And we also want to identify the costliest, most vulnerable subset of high utilizers. Information like that can help inform Medicaid 1115 waiver design and other interventions which are cheaper than emergency department medical care. And finally, we really want to demonstrate return on investment by analyzing the utilization costs versus the cost of housing and services, which can underline the need for supportive housing and the benefit at the individual and population level health. So, what is happening between Department of Health and our statewide COC? In November of 2025, we started a health data sharing pilot, which was about 2 years in development. We are sharing a single data point, which is Medicaid enrollment status, so that we can take lists of people who are in shelters or in housing programs, compare it to lists with the Department of Health, and understand who has health insurance and seeking services in multiple federally funded programs. We also hope to upgrade the HMIS software. We've applied to RHTP funding. We really want interoperability with state data systems, not just health systems, but the Department of Corrections and Department of Family Services. If somebody's being let out of prison and discharged to an unknown location, they shouldn't end up in Brother Francis Shelter if there's a housing program and a bed available for them, and they're not unnecessarily in a congregate shelter. Similarly, with Department of Family Services, if there's a family for whom a child removal is a consideration due to housing status, we want to provide as much support to that family to get them housed and ideally not end up with a child removed from the family's home. Stable funding for housing and homelessness services. We all know that every year the funds are always questionable. The homeless assistance program primarily is funded through the general fund. And when small organizations who provide services to the most challenging clients that exist in our state with serious health conditions and co-occurring disorders, when their funding is at risk every year, it's very hard to plan into the future. The frontline organizations do the enormous amount of work serving people with complex needs, and any disruption in staffing or service array is very difficult for both clients and for the providers. And finally, we hope to continue working closely with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the Alaska Mental Health Trust in setting policies that benefit vulnerable clients. Both of those state organizations mandate use of our data system, HMIS, to track certain programs, but there is not concurrent funding with those mandates to use the HMIS data, and that HMIS data generates reports about client outcomes for folks receiving services through AHFC and Alaska Mental Health Trust. Thank you so much, Chair. That is all I have, but I have time for questions. And if I don't have the answer to your question, I can follow up with your offices after this meeting.
Perfect. Any questions from the committee? I see Rep. Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm curious if, Mr. Brooks, you're able, in partnership with the state agencies, to delineate state and local savings, because it strikes me that under this model, we are largely paying as local property taxpayers and saving money for the state, which I guess good for saving money for the state. But I think as a starting point, understanding some of those savings would be beneficial.
Through the chair to Representative Fields, I'm happy to supply your office with an extensive research done here in Juneau of Forget-Me-Not Manor of the clients who were placed into housing and then the impact of that housing on reductions in emergency services, the reduction in police calls, the reduction in emergency department calls. Those savings primarily were to the municipality, right, the police department and the hospital. But also to Medicaid spending. I mean, these people were, yeah, I'm happy to provide the report to you. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Well, through the follow-up. I just want to, especially in Anchorage, try to identify the contribution to state savings. How much, could I ask another follow-up? Do you have a sense of how much does Anchorage, at the local level, invest in housing, what you could broadly call housing first? So not like the mobile firefighters who go out and help homeless people, but just the housing element of it.
As the Alaska Coalition, we operate everywhere outside of Anchorage, so I don't have the Anchorage specific, like the municipal data for you.
Got it. Okay.
Sorry, through the chair, but I'm sure we could help connect you with that information.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Prox.
Yes. Thank you. The graphs and whatnot that you provided that was targeted, was that targeted for people who are on some sort of public assistance one way or another, as opposed to the general population?
Thank you, through the chair. That data was collected by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation for all housing, not just people receiving social services or federally funded housing program in federally funded housing programs. That was an assessment of the entire housing stock in the state.
Follow up.
I guess we'd almost have to look at that specific slide, but just amazed. 50-65% of the housing general population, well, it's by ANSC corporation area, but I would think Doyon, for instance, is Fairbanks.
Is this the graph you're referring to?
Well, I'm not sure which one, but
okay.
Well, any of them. It seemed very high for the general population, and indoor air quality and stuff being poor. That it strikes me as high. It would be interesting to know more about that.
Yeah, this study was through the chair. To the representative, this study was completed in 2018. Prior to 2018, AHFC did this study roughly every 4 to 5 years. We don't have a current one, so the information might have changed since what we see in this graph. But unless there's been significant housing development in an ANCSA region, it's unlikely that this data has changed that much. And we would still like an updated housing assessment for the state.
Follow up.
Yes, thank you. So where again would we find this data?
This, through the chair to the representative, this report is all available on the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation website. If you search for 2018 Alaska Housing Assessment, it will pop up, and you can also break it down not by ANCSA region. You can look by census tract as well.
Okay. Well, I guess one more.
One more.
And that would be, you had some return on investment analysis, I think you call it. Was that in the same report?
No. What we're hoping to achieve with data sharing and data interoperability is to look at that return on investment and cost savings. Currently, we don't have a mechanism with our software to pull medical spending on an individual or household, and then look at what housing spending has been for that household. And what we're really hoping to look at is what was medical spending before they were housed versus what is medical spending, does it reduce with housing and services, mm-hmm. supportive services.
And then finally?
Finally, and I know Mr. Owens has to step to Senate Health and Social Services as well.
Okay, yes. Whoops. Did I just forget what I was going to ask? Oh, yes. I think you indicated that you are applying for some of this rural health transformation money.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay.
We are hoping to update our data system so it can share data with the State Department of Health.
Okay, thank you.
Great. I have two quick questions, and then we will let you go to Senate Health and Social Services. My first question was, what would you say are the top three most important state grants that you all follow that makes an impact to unhoused people?
There are two that are, through the chair, thank you for the question. There are two that are vitally important. It's the special needs housing grants, and second, the housing assistance program. Last year, the housing assistance program saw the first increase it's seen in over a decade, from roughly $7 million to $10.15 million. It was also the first year that they were able to open up that grant to other housing providers and homeless service providers in other communities. The current budget has that cut down by half. That would be absolutely devastating to housing and homeless service providers. That grant funds things like emergency crisis lines if a family finds themselves homeless in the middle of the night in rural communities. And then the special needs housing grant really focuses on people with severe disabilities and helps provide housing for people with significant health issues.
And just to follow up, where are those grants located between the mental health budget and AHFC? And how do you all coordinate with the Mental Health Trust Authority and the Housing Finance Corporation?
Those grants are in the Mental Health Trust budget. However, a very small portion of the funds in them are from the Mental Health budget. The majority of the funds are from the general fund. The Alaska Mental Health Trust budget process is in advance often, multiple years, and is complicated and kind of separate from the legislative process for budgeting. And we try to coordinate with them as best we can. I think there are some limitations in our ability to coordinate with them. And there's at times a lack of transparency about those processes. We would like to be a good partner in participating in those processes, but you know, HFC has been amazing at administering the housing assistance program. They have done amazing things providing funding to those homeless service providers. That increase in funds last year was really game changer, and we work closely with the staff there who administers it. We want to pair them with the federally funded COC program so that those programs have enough to actually operate. None of the recipients of those grants and our grants receive enough funds to operate a complete program from either of the fund sources.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And we really appreciate your time today in the House Health and Social Services Committee. And I believe that is our presentation for today. So thank you so much for presenting to us. And I also want to clarify that the resource navigation is 211, operated by United Way. They're in my district. Anyway, we will now move on to our next item on the agenda. Thank you so much. We are returning to House Bill 242 by Representative Sarah Hannon on sexual assault by healthcare workers. We received no amendments by yesterday's amendment deadline. Do we have any questions for the bill sponsor? And I also note that we have available Angie Kemp, Deputy Attorney General.
No questions.
All right. Seeing no questions from the committee, if there's no further discussion, I would like to now entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Chair Mina, I move House Bill 242, Work Order 34-LS1164/alpha.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Pause. Attagis. My apologies. I did not notice Representative Prox in my wing. Representative Prox, did you have a comment or question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We were discussing this in our office this afternoon, and it occurred to us that it might be worth considering applying essentially the same statute to a number of other offices or professions where there is an imbalance of power. And I don't want to hold the bill up because I think the next stop is a Judiciary Committee, but we do have, you said, somebody from the Attorney General's office here or online.
She's here.
And I just wonder if they have given that any thought.
But Casey Schroeder is here.
Oh.
Assistant Attorney General.
I would like to invite Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General, up to answer Representative Prox's question.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Madam Chair, could the question be repeated?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, we were discussing this power imbalance, and it kind of makes sense that someone would be the most vulnerable in a healthcare situation, but there's other situations where there's an imbalance of power, and essentially the same thing could happen. An assault, a non-consensual, maybe somewhat ambiguous on consent, et cetera, but the same idea that you hear about this a lot in the entertainment industry. as an example.
Through the chair to Representative Prox, there are a number of other subsections in the sexual assault statutes that may apply depending on the facts of the case. This bill in particular deals with someone who is a healthcare worker, which has a specific definition in statute.
Right.
There is also another statute. There's another theory that can be charged, which is the without consent theory. And there is a statute that offers guidance to prosecutors in what without consent means. The subsections of that guidance is, and it's found in 1141.445, is that a person cannot consent if the person is fraudulently made to believe that the sexual act serves a professional purpose. Professional purpose in this paragraph means the act that the defendant has represented as a necessary part or component of a provided service, part of a routine course of a procedure, or a component of the defendant's profession that would occur if a person sought services from another practitioner in the same field as the defendant. So while a healthcare worker has a specific definition that generally applies to healthcare professions, where somebody is engaging in this type of activity that exceeds the bounds of consent and they are representing that it's for a professional purpose, we could also look at another theory and charge under that theory, which would be the without consent theory. And an example that was given when this provision was being enacted is that these could be healthcare professionals, but they could also be yoga instructors, personal trainers, people that are acting in the course of their profession, and perhaps that profession involves some sort of touching or other side type of conduct that could exceed the bounds of consent.
Mm-hmm. And I guess through the chair, just kind of off the top of your head, is that worth devoting some thought to that potential problem? Clarify in those situations, I'm not sure.
Through the chair to Representative Prox, I think that the criminal division's perspective of the professional aspects, both the healthcare worker, is pretty expansive. There's also a provision that allows us to try to argue that somebody is in a similar situation as a healthcare worker, so that's a pretty broad definition. And the professional purpose definition is also pretty broad. So when you're talking about a professional context, we think that we've probably got most things covered, although I will admit that the professional purpose language is relatively new, has not been tested, and obviously if it becomes a problem, we would come back before the legislature and articulate what fixes we think would be needed. In other contexts where somebody is exceeding the bounds of consent, the without the consent definition has also changed recently and involves a back and forth. Mm-hmm. So find it here. Without consent means that under the totality of the circumstances surrounding the offense, there was not a freely given reversible agreement specific to the conduct at issue. In this paragraph, freely given means an agreement to cooperate in the act was positively expressed by word or action. So this is a relatively new subsection. It was changed in the last few years, and it's more expansive. It more closely aligns with how people view consent and would likely be able to cover situations where maybe an employer was pressuring a subordinate and things like that. So it's difficult to consent in when those power dynamics, and that's probably the subsection we would look at if we were ever to get a case involving that type of relationship.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Schroeder or for the bill sponsor, or any other discussion on the bill? All right. Seeing none. Representative Gray.
Chair Mina, I move House Bill 242, Work Order 34-LS1164/A as an alpha from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 242 passes from committee. Please stick around after we adjourn to sign the committee report. The next meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will be Thursday, March 26 at 3:30 p.m. Please note the time change. We will be meeting jointly with Senate Health and Social Services to hear the annual Citizens Review Panel Report and Office of Children's Services response. The time is 4:14 p.m., and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.